Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is music journalist Jonathan Scott, and we're talking about his new book, Into the Groove, the story of sound from tinfoil to vinyl. Jonathan, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure, finally, to talk about this book with you. It's wild.
Oh, well, thanks so much. It's great to be with you, and thanks very much for having me on.
What was interesting to me is that in the introduction to this, you said that you don't understand records yourself. Was that your impetus for doing all the research for this book?
Well, yes, and to be honest, in ways I still don't. I describe in the beginning that feeling of wonder you get when you're a five-year-old kid and you first see a record playing. And I still sort of get that when I put my records on sometimes. And it was that sort of feeling, of wonder at the technology that I kind of wanted to keep hold of while I was writing about it. Because we're all used to having sound completely at our beck and call. You know, we're a very lucky generations. It's becoming easier and easier to have sound do what you want. And I guess I wanted to strip some of that away and kind of remind ourselves how lucky we are and that we've got to this place thanks to the groove, you know, the technology of records.
Well, and you yourself, Jonathan, you yourself are a big vinyl person.
Yes, definitely. Yes, I mean, I definitely am. Although I've got loads of CDs and I've still got quite a lot of tapes as well, so I'd say I'm really a format man. But if I had to choose one, yes, it would be vinyl if I could only choose one. Definitely.
Well, the amazing thing being here at the radio station long enough, I've been here since '71. I get to see the whole transition that I actually played on the air from record to cassettes to CDs to MP3s.
Yeah.
And beyond.
Yeah, well, you know all about it. And then, I mean, that's the thing, because, like...
I know about the format. I don't know how it works.
Yeah, well, like I say, I mean, I think it's because I still... If you put on a record right now, and it's just a disc of bumpy plastic, and you hear all this music coming out of it, it's just staggering. It's a bit like, you know, we all take radio for granted.
Oh, yeah.
But it's still an amazing thing if you remember what it was like before you knew really how radio worked. You know, it's just incredible that we're so lucky.
There's so much detail in this book, and we're all going to be able to talk about it, the sort of the beginnings. And I want to tell the audience that, man, pick up the book because the rest of the book is wild. I was surprised. You actually started all the way back with Galileo in 1632. You've got to explain why.
Well, it's just in order to understand how the records came about, it just felt like it was important to go right back to our earliest understandings of sound. And it was Galileo who just wrote about an experiment where he watched how the resonance of sound made dust particles dance around and form parallel lines. And then, you know, that first experiment, first point, then develops to a whole period of experimentation and eventually comes up to, you know, it furthered exactly how we humans realized that sound was a physical force that could in some way be recorded in physical objects because of the way it impacted the environment around it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it's sort of, people had to realize that sound could be represented in a visual, physical form.
Exactly, and one of the key sort of turning points in the story is in the 1850s in Paris, when a wonderful sounding Frenchman called Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville, who is a typesetter by trade, but he was working on a book, as in he was printing the book, and it had a diagram of an ear, and he kind of thought to himself, why can't we try and create something that does for sound what photography had been doing for light? And long story short, he created what's known as the phonautograph. And this was the first object that could that was designed to preserve sound waves, but not play them back.
I know, that's like so frustrating when you get to that part of the way. Yes, they were able to record sound, but that critical second part of it was...
I know. But this is the thing. He just invented this thing, this phonautograph, because... It basically traced sound waves in sort of essentially soot on paper.
And he used a boar's bristle, right?
Yeah, that's right. The stylus was a boar's bristle. And I think later he used a barb of a feather as well. But the point is, he was doing it to, you know, so he could read sound waves. He felt that if we could learn, human beings could learn to sort of read the sound waves, it would almost become like a natural handwriting of sound, if you see what I mean. So if you said hello and then looked at the sound waves, you could tell, oh yeah, that's someone saying hello. Now, the reality is you couldn't do that, but it was still a, you know, a key turning point in terms of sound, and it was still a successful invention in terms of our of what it helped us understand. But yeah, the playing back of sound, that all-important thing, didn't come for another 20 years or so.
Well, I want to stick with Scott for a minute, because he made a number of recordings, again, unplayable. But here's the thing that you wrote about that just struck me as hilarious. People still collected them.
Yeah. I know. There was a particular American. I've actually forgotten his name.
It's Charles Banker or B-A-N-C-K-E-R.
Yeah, he basically collected any new scientific instruments. He was just a keen fan of science and scientists, and he read about this new phonautograph thing and bought one, and then it ended up in a museum in Philadelphia, I think I'm remembering right, and
yep.
There's actually a notification of people actually using it and recording and making the phonautograms, as they're called, these papery, you know. But the point is, the sort of slightly spine-tingling thing about those phonautograms is that if they could ever be found, they would be the first recorded sounds recorded on American soil, the earliest recorded sounds. Unfortunately, no one's found them yet, those phonautograms that he collected. But yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating. Anything to do with sound, and human beings will collect it.
But there is recent technology, I think it was 2008, they were able to resurrect the sound in this really complicated process on some of these early sound recordings. There was a woman singing Eau Claire de Lune, and recorded in 1860, and through sorts of weird contemporary use of computers and stuff like that, they were able to play it back.
Yeah, it's amazing. Go to any listeners who are interested in hearing it should go to firstsounds.org. I'm not associated with it in any way, but that's just where you can find out all about it. It's called Project Irene, and essentially, putting it in very simple terms, because it's really complicated, but they kind of did a sort of 3D scanning on the sound, and were able to recreate the sound waves. And yet, it's absolutely spine-tingling. Actually, that turned out to be... You're totally right.
It turned out to be
Edwarden himself, because when they first reconstructed the sound, they'd misread the sort of time signature, and so they'd made it a bit too fast. So yes, at first, it sounded like a woman going... That's exactly what she sounded like. And then when they realized, oh, actually, it's a man's voice, and you can hear it now. It's just amazing. A man's voice from 1860, and they think it probably is... You know, Edward Leon Scott de Martinville himself, and he's just sort of singing out a mournful tune very slowly, probably to try and make it so the sound waves properly get recorded. It's fascinating.
Well, there's so many fascinating things in this early history of recording. You actually have a section on automatons, synthesizing the human voice. There was Joseph Faber and his euphonia. Or the wonderful talking machine. And as you described it, it was slow, mournful, and creepy as hell.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite digressions, the whole automaton thing, just because...
What a weird thing that they were able to duplicate the human voice, though.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Joseph Faber dedicated his life to creating this machine. He gave it a sort of face as well, and basically by a really complicated series of keys and bellows, he could make this thing sing or speak very quite slowly. But by all accounts, it definitely turned some heads. Some people really liked it, but a lot of people just slightly giggled at it, you know. But it's just an interesting cultural phenomenon again, because when people first heard that Edison, jumping ahead, had made a talking machine, everyone assumed, or a lot of people assumed, that it would be really complicated, you know, like Faber's weird automaton. They thought, wow, a machine that can talk, that's going to be really complicated. But when you see the original Edison talking machine, as it was called, it's really quite simple looking. You know, it looks like a lathe. It looks like something that could be in any workshop.
It's totally weird. By the way, I want to mention that poor Joseph Faber ended up destroying the machine and killing himself.
Yeah, no, it's a, It's a sad and strange little story, but it just in terms of the sort of the popular conception of sound in the 1870s and the idea of a talking machine in the 1870s, it felt like it was an important digression to go down. And anything that's really weird, I love writing about.
Oh, yeah, and I love reading about it. Now, there's this person, Charles Cross, C-R-O-S. He was described as a rhymer, a chemist, a fiddler, and a buffoon. He wanted to make contact with Venus during the transit, but he ended up describing a process of recording and reproducing audible phenomena. Had he envisioned the record?
Yes. I mean, essentially he had. He was a Parisian, and he's really celebrated in Paris to this day. Even though he didn't manage to make his invention come to life, he wrote a letter to the Academy of Sciences in Paris in which he described a way you could record and reproduce sound that essentially used a different technology to the one that Edison would go for. It used a kind of photo-engraving technology, but it was scientifically sound as a method. And it was in April, he wrote this letter in April 1877, so if before Edison had his eureka moment, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So he's, as I say, he's celebrated as being an important figure, even though he wasn't first to get there. You know, it's a bit like in the invention of the telephone. There are various, you know, Alexander Graham Bell is the one that's credited with it, but there are plenty of other scientists, thinkers who were working in very similar areas at the same time.
It's amazing because they're all in this book. The first time the word phonograph was used was in a patent by F.B. Fenby. And the first actual phonograph was Charles Batchelor, who experimented with different materials.
Yeah. But the I totally agree. I found Charles Cross, he was such a... I mean, it sounds like he was a really, just a fascinating human being. You know, just interested in science. Apparently, he used to go to this school for deaf children and sort of perform for them. And apparently, he could really make them laugh by pulling loads of silly faces. And he just sounds like a really interesting but slightly troubled human being. He died quite young, and he did like absinthe quite a lot. But, yeah. But still,
that was a very popular downfall at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Edison's first machine, and it's difficult for people to envision this, was this weird cylinder, and it ended up, they tried a lot of different materials, but they ended up covering the cylinder with tinfoil. How was the sound recorded on that?
Right, yeah, that's right. So if you imagine a lathe, a sort of hand-cranked cylinder on a feed screw, and the cylinder has ready-made grooves, okay? The grooves are already in there, and then you wrap tin foil or aluminum foil around it, okay? Then you place, there's a sort of mouthpiece, looks a bit like an old-fashioned telephone mouthpiece with a diaphragm and a spike on it, and you speak into the mouthpiece. The sound waves go down the mouthpiece into the diaphragm, vibrate it around, and then as you're rotating the cylinder, the little spike impresses the sound into the tinfoil.
Whoa.
You see?
It seems incredibly fragile.
If you play it back, it gives you the sound back.
It sounds very fragile.
It is, yeah. Well, this is the thing. It was a lovely thing to be able to write about because I'm not taking any credit away from Edison's invention, because this was the first time humanity had recorded and played back sound. But that original tinfoil phonograph, which was first revealed to the public in December 1877, was a complete pain in the bum to use.
I know.
It was really heavy. It cost loads to make, and only, you know, loads of practice could you get anything out of it. And as well, yes, the record itself, just tinfoil, it was really fragile. So if let's say, like, when it was first announced that they had made this amazing thing, like a lot of sort of Victorian era marketing and advertising, they really focused on, won't it be amazing that you will be able to record the voices of loved ones and then play them back once they've passed away? You know, they really focused on that quite a lot. just like they did with photography back then. But the point is that, like, if you record something on tinfoil, taking the tinfoil off the record player will, unless you're incredibly careful, will destroy the recording. But I think in the immediate aftermath, and again, this was another fascinating period of the story, because the tinfoil phonograph was launched. It made, you know, column inches, headlines across the world. Everyone was really impressed with it. But then not much happened with it.
Well, you write that it sounded like Edison lost interest in it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is that Edison was a brilliant man, but his main focus was not making money in the sense that he just wanted as much money as he could. He wanted money so he could carry on working. He loved working. He loved the camaraderie of the laboratory. You know, that's where he was happiest.
He also loved patents.
Yeah, exactly. And the main thing he invented the phonograph and then very soon was sidetracked by the light bulb. That was the next big project, and that was a far more profitable thing. So the phonograph, this tricksy tinfoil thing that was hard to make any practical use of, it was only really any use as a sort of, you know, parlor entertainment, he just put to one side so he could concentrate on light bulbs, and that became his focus.
Didn't he develop the commercial rights? He lists three possibilities of how to use this technology. It was phonograph itself, dolls and music boxes, and timepieces. That's my favorite. Somehow this would be useful in timepiece.
Well, he would carry on. I mean, his number one idea for the phonograph was that it would be used in business.
Okay.
Music was down on his list. And actually, if you listen, you can go and listen to a couple of very fragile early recordings of rare surviving tinfoil records. And they will make you realize why perhaps he wasn't that interested in music, because the sound is pretty dreadful.
And am I right in thinking that they also could not be reproduced? In other words, it's a singular recording, that's it.
Yeah, that's right. And basically, to leap ahead, when the first, shall we say, successful phonographs came along, which were cylinders, and by then the cylinders were made of wax, yeah, there was no way of making a copy of a record. So when the music industry actually gets going in the 1890s, if you wanted a copy of, you know, another copy of I don't know, a brass band tune, you had to go and ask them to play it again. And it's just a really strange idea. I mean, imagine going up to the Beatles and saying, oh, could I have another Love Me Do, please? You know, it's just, it's a strange kind of thing. But again, that's another period that I could enthuse about all day long. The 1890s is the sort of birth of the recording industry, and it's a fascinating period.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is music journalist Jonathan Scott, and we're talking about his new book. It is amazing. Into the Groove, the story of sound from tinfoil to vinyl. What's the gramophone?
Ah, well, the gramophone came about in the 1890s, and that was another brilliant American, a German-American, as in German-born American, called Emil Berliner. And he was looking at cylinder records, which by now had taken off, and he just felt that discs would be a much better shape. One of the main reasons being that right from the off, you could make a print, you know, a matrix print of the record, and therefore from one recording stamp out loads of copies. And when he finally perfected, or nearly perfected, his first record player, he called it the Gramophone, and then formed the Gramophone Company in America. And again, he's another really interesting man. He sounds like you can actually hear him speaking in these very early recordings, because the very first records, disc-shaped records that were commercially available, came about because he visited Germany in 1889, I think I'm remembering right, and a toy company created the first gramophone records. And the sound is really bad. They were using a kind of hardened rubber to make the discs, and the sound was so bad that they had a little bit of paper on the back on which they printed what was being said on the record to help people kind of understand what was being said. But you can go and listen to him. You can go and listen to, like, Old King Cole. you hear this lovely Germanic accent saying, "Old King Cole," and you can play it back. It's just amazing to me that we can listen to these things so easily. But yeah, that's where the gramophone came along, and discs didn't immediately take over from cylinders. Cylinders and discs sort of coexisted for some time. It's a bit like, you know, Neanderthals and Homo sapiens.
But one was destined to overcome the other. That transition from cylinder to disc, though, is so crucial to sound recording.
Yeah, it definitely is. And at first, cylinders sounded better. You know, the technology had been more perfected before discs turned up on the scene. And they did sound better, but discs could be made much more cheaply. But then also, as discs developed, the sound got better You know, he moved to shellac, which was what old 78 records were made out of, which is
You could reproduce them.
Yeah, exactly. And you could reproduce them. By this, I mean, cylinders caught up, as in they figured out a way of molding cylinders. And Edison just would not let go of the cylinder. So the last cylinders were still being made right up until 1929.
Wow.
But by then, they were definitely a sort of fringe item that only certain people love. But, you know, there are still cylinder collectors to this day. And you can, that's another thing you can do. You can go on YouTube and you can tell, you know, a really clean, well-made cylinder sounds marvelous. You know, they really did have great sound.
I got to ask you about this before we run out of time. The first recording of the F-bomb, you actually included in your book. And this is the kind of stuff that's in your book, which I love. It makes the book so fascinating to read. Who recorded the first F-bomb?
Well, I'm delighted you asked, because, yes, I'm a very puerile man, so I particularly enjoy telling this part of the story. But in one of my favorite bits of the whole thing was the 1880s Washington, D.C., because you see, that bit we talked about, Edison had launched his phonograph, but no one was really using it. Alexander Graham Bell formed a laboratory called Volta Associates in Washington, D.C., and there, over a period of 5 years, he and his colleagues worked on all kinds of strange experimental ways of recording sound. You can go and listen to them again at firstsounds.org. There's a whole load of them digitized there. And they tried discs, they tried cylinders, they made them out of metal, glass. You know, they recorded them using sort of light. It's fascinating. But one of the discs has them experimenting, and you can hear this it's not a very good recording again. It's a disc-shaped one made of glass, I think. And you can hear this recording of a man saying, "Mary had a little lamb, his fleece as white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went," and then there's this,
Wow, wow!
And it's just lovely, because the thing is, it's really hard to hear, but whether it's actual, an actual F-bomb or not, it's definitely the sound of human vexation. And it's lovely to be able to sort of put your ear to the door of a laboratory in Washington, D.C. in 1885 and hear someone cussing.
Well, there's and as music becomes to be recorded and then reproduced, the fascinating part of your book is how music was being reshaped by the technology. Literally reshaped by the phonograph. Initially, musicians grumbled about recordings because they thought it would kill live performances.
Yeah, I mean, and definitely, I mean, that was true in a sense, you know, because before records came along, think about it, the only way of playing or hearing music was either to see it live or to learn yourself. That was it. Those were your options. And also, many musicians were just sort of rather suspicious of this. You know, you go into a room, there's a recording horn there, you play, you're given a flat fee, and then you lose all control over what you've done. And obviously it took time for sort of contracts and copyrights to sort of make it so they got a fair cut later on. But, you know, it was just, they were very suspicious of it, and some just totally disliked it. John Philip Sousa, in fact, he was one of the first, he was like the Beatles of the 1890s. He did brass band music that, like, sold thousands. But he grew to worry that canned music, as he called it, would just sort of destroy humans wanting to learn instruments because it was so much easier to just listen to them. Which, you know, again, maybe there's partial truth in that, because certainly before records, everyone, you know, wanted to learn an instrument if they could. Whereas now, the moment you had records on tap, maybe you didn't need to so much.
We're almost out of time, but you mentioned in your introduction, it starts out, 1977 was a pivotal year for vinyl. Why?
Well, it's there's so much that happens in 1977. It's 100 year, it's the 100th anniversary of the original phonograph. It's the year that Rumours came out. It's the year that Bat Out of Hell came out. It's the year that punk really exploded.
Yeah.
It's the year of peak vinyl sales in America. That was as high as it ever got.
Is that the year that the Voyager...
the Voyager Golden Record set sail for deep space. And for me, that was such a lovely part of the story. I'd already written a book about the Voyager Golden Record.
That's right.
But the fact that 100 years on from the first tinfoil phonograph and the groove, the format of records was going interstellar, just felt like such an amazing arc, you know, story of records.
What was the player like for the Voyager?
The record player?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they didn't send a record player.
I know, I was straight-lining you on that one. That's the part I never realized. Like, I knew all about the Golden Record, but I didn't realize they didn't send anything to play. Do you know how frustrating that would be if you were an alien race?
As you can imagine, I could talk for years about.
Okay. But and we're going to have to end there because we've run out of time.
Okay.
But that's one of the most amazing facts. My guest tonight has been music journalist Jonathan Scott, and we've been talking about his new book. It's just chock full of all sorts of great information, and it's a fascinating history. Into the Groove: The Story of Sound from Tinfoil to Vinyl. Jonathan, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been really fun.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.